Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Benedict Rogers. His book is The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny. It was published by Optimum Publishing International in 2022. Now, Benedict Rogers is a human rights activist and writer specializing in Asia. He's the co-founder and chief executive officer of Hong Kong Watch. We're going to talk quite a bit about some of the work that comes through in his book today, so I'll let him tell you a bit more about himself. But without further ado, Benedict Rogers, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, just to get us started, I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to write The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny.
Well, I first went to China when I was 18 years old to spend 6 months teaching English in Qingdao, the city on the east coast of China, as part of my gap year before university. And that's how I got interested and involved in China. I fell in love with China during that time, and then subsequently traveled many times throughout China and lived in Hong Kong for 5 years, the first 5 years after the handover. And I don't think I ever anticipated then that the day would come where I would be feeling that I would have to be speaking out so much about the human rights situation across China, and especially the situation in Hong Kong. But sadly, the way the situation has deteriorated, there came a point around about 2014 when the umbrella movement started in Hong Kong, where I felt that there was a need to speak out, particularly having lived in Hong Kong. And so that's how I started Hong Kong Watch. And then the book came about because a couple of years ago, I had the idea. I had written some books previously on other issues, but I sort of felt an itch to write another book, and China was the obvious topic for me. I did initially think, well, there are so many books on China. What can I really bring that adds value? But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that although there are thousands of books on China, there are very, very few, indeed, really, if any, that put the different human rights issues in China together in the way that I've done, and with a little bit of a personal context to it. So that's how it came about.
Yeah, and actually that was one of the things I really enjoyed and really sort of got me into the book, that sort of personal connection. You did open the book, and just taking you back to that moment, you mentioned Qingdao. You opened with this, like, it was this rollicking tale of, you know, this young person having a fantastic time in Qingdao. Just for a little bit of background, can you just tell us a little bit more about your times there and how that sort of shaped your relationship with China and Chinese people?
Well, I had just a wonderfully fun and fulfilling and I think formative experience in Qingdao. I had applied for a placement with an organization that places gap year students in different parts of China and indeed around the world. And I'd applied for their China program. It's quite a competitive program, but I was selected. My adventure sort of started with, normally this organization sends people in pairs. And but at Heathrow Airport, as I was with all the other volunteer teachers flying out together, I got the news that the person who had been paired with me had actually become really scared of going and so had pulled out. And so I was told, you have to go to Qingdao on your own. And I'd never been to China. I'd never been to, well, I'd been to one or two parts of Asia, but I basically had, that was with my family. You know, I was 18 years old, so it was my, really my first time away from home for any length of time. And we all flew out to Beijing together. I was with all the other teachers. We had a couple of days orientation in Beijing. We found that our luggage had been stuck in Karachi because we'd flown on Pakistani Airways through Karachi. And then the moment came when one by one, two by two, all the other volunteer teachers went off to their different cities. And I was the last one. My flight happened to be the last one to leave. And suddenly I was on my own. And I thought, wow, what do I do? But I think that experience kind of actually forced me to make friends with a lot of the people in Qingdao, maybe more quickly than I might have done if I'd been with another British student. And so I made a lot of friends among the students I was teaching who were more or less the same age as me and some of the other teachers. And it shaped my future in the sense that it gave me a real love of China. And given what I do now, I'm always very keen, and I hope this comes through in the book, to make a distinction between China and the Chinese Communist Party. And, you know, I love China and the people of China. I'm certainly not anti-China, but I am critical of the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, that really does come through in the book. And as you said just a moment ago, it sort of, it provides sort of an explanation. It makes sense why you would speak out on behalf of, you know, and talk about the things that you've witnessed and advocated for and worked in and researched in. So yes, that certainly does come through in the book. I just want to, you know, just before we move on, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, you said things changed in 2014. And then of course in 2017, you were denied entry to Hong Kong. And you can't visit China anymore either. So I'm wondering if you can just fill the listeners in what happened here, because I understand you were perhaps the first foreigner to actually be denied entry into Hong Kong. And it was almost a sign of things to come. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so after I left Hong Kong in 2002, having lived there for 5 years, I went back fairly often between 2002 and 2017, to see friends. But it wasn't until 2014, when the umbrella movement happened, that I began to be quite public on the political and human rights issues. And I'd started writing opinion pieces. I'd organized a little campaign when Joshua Wong, Alex Chow, and Nathan Law were imprisoned. And then I'd also hosted a number of Hong Kong activists when they came to London. And then earlier in 2017, I was doing all of this until that point in my spare time, kind of on my own as an individual. And by 2017, I had felt that there was a need for an organization to advocate on Hong Kong. I felt it was no longer sustainable for me on my own in my spare time. And so we were planning to establish Hong Kong Watch. I had come together with a few other friends who had a similar vision. But in order to, or in preparation for launching Hong Kong Watch, I had felt that I should make another visit to Hong Kong to talk to people and get an update about the situation before launching the organization. And so I was traveling. I was actually at a conference in Bangkok, and my plan was to tag a short trip to Hong Kong off the back of my time in Bangkok. A few days before flying to Hong Kong from Bangkok, I did receive some advance notice that there might be a problem, in that basically the Chinese embassy in London had somehow found out. I hadn't publicized my visit, but they'd somehow found out I was intending to go. And they started contacting all sorts of people in London, members of parliament, people in the British government, And one MP who knows me contacted me and said, look, I've heard from the Chinese embassy and I'm concerned for you. So I took advice on whether I should still go or not. I took advice from senior people in Hong Kong in the pro-democracy movement and some political figures back home in London. And everybody was of the view that this was an attempt by the Chinese regime to intimidate me into not going, but that most likely, once I landed in Hong Kong, that the matter would be in the hands of Hong Kong's immigration department, and that on balance, the view was it was still likely that they would allow me in and it wouldn't be a problem. But people also said to me, if they're serious about doing this, about denying you entry, the world needs to know, because this would be a serious issue and a serious violation of Hong Kong's autonomy. And the only way to find out is to go and see what happens. So I agreed with all of that. I flew to Hong Kong, and as it happened, they were more serious than I think we had realized. Although everything that's happened in Hong Kong since then makes my little incident, you know, pale into insignificance. At the time, I think it was quite a serious warning sign of what was to come.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly remember reading about it at that time, and it was quite a shock that, you know, something like that would happen in Hong Kong at that stage, because, you know, it was a few years before the anti-extradition movement. I don't think it was necessarily on the public in Hong Kong's radar that something like that, that, you know, especially, you know, someone from overseas would be denied entry at that stage, because, you know, Hong Kong was understood as this place of free speech and public discourse. So yeah, it was quite a shock, I think. I want to just, before we move on to the sort of more substantive part of the book, just take you back a little bit to the time when you just mentioned you lived in Hong Kong from 2002 for 5 years, and that was when you were a rookie journalist. Again, that sounded like quite a fun and exciting time. I liked reading about all your adventures, but I liked reading not just about both your direct experience, but also how as a rookie journalist, you seem to witness already in 2002, from 2002 onwards, some of the changing political tides in this, you know, initial five period that you were working there. Can you reflect a little bit upon the sort of changes that were taking place? Because, of course, this was just in the period after the handover in 1997 from the UK back to China. So, you know, what can, just reflecting upon that, you know, what did you see when you were there?
Well, I think probably the most significant kind of early warning sign of worse to come, although I didn't know at the time how much worse would come all these years later, was the change in my sort of final year there with the newspaper that I was working on. Because I would say overall, my experience of those first 5 years after the handover was that One Country, Two Systems overall was working pretty well. Hong Kong's basic freedoms were intact, and including press freedom. And I was able, I describe in the book some of the kind of opinion pieces that I was able to write and publish, pieces that you would just never be able to publish in Hong Kong today. So overall, I think things were in a good place. But there were some more subtle signs. And the biggest example of that was when the newspaper I worked on, which was called the Hong Kong iMail, and it was very much positioned when I joined it as a free-thinking, quite bold, critical of Beijing and of the Hong Kong government, sort of independent, pro-democracy voice. And it had been owned by the investment bank Lazards, and then they sold it to the Hong Kong tobacco tycoon Charles Ho. And initially, Charles Ho didn't change anything, but then suddenly, one day, in I guess 2000 and early in 2002, he sacked the editor. He sacked quite a lot of other people. Brought in a new editor who basically told us all we could no longer be as outspoken and bold as we had been, and that pretty much we were going to be turned into a pro-Beijing business focused newspaper. And I was thinking of leaving Hong Kong anyway for other personal reasons, but I knew then that I couldn't stay on that newspaper if that was the direction it was going to take. And so then a few months later, I left. I had been the editorial writer, so I'd been writing the newspaper's editorials. And I said to this new editor, you know, if you're going to ask me to write pro-Beijing editorials, then I might as well stop writing editorials now, and which I did. But I stayed on the paper for a few more months doing features and other things, and then I left. And I think that was the most obvious example. There were some other examples that I cite in the book, but I think the difference between then and now is that actually it was a case of self-censorship by newspaper proprietors and bringing in people who do their bidding, rather than being imposed as it is now by Beijing.
Yeah, and that that does make sense because, since the introduction of, for example, the national security law, you know, the censorship is obvious, both directly and also, there is necessarily self-censorship because of the offences under the NSL. So I want to turn to the next chapter of the book, which is titled China's Crackdown After a Decade of Opening, The Shrinking Space for Lawyers, Civil Society, Media and Dissent. Now, because, the title of the book, of course, is the China Nexus, but it all comes back to, this sort of central ruling party governance. So can you tell me, going back to... Firstly, prior to November 2012, when the transfer of power to Xi Jinping began, you were frequently in and around mainland China, and you wrote in the book that during that period, on paper, it seemed as if China might have been opening up, but in reality, there were crackdowns on civil society, media and dissent, and you've just mentioned, crackdowns on media and dissent. So can you tell me about those crackdowns and the silencing of dissidents in that period?
Yes, so I think, as I describe, in the early 2000s, there was this space that emerged for Chinese lawyers to defend some human rights-related cases. There were independent bloggers and civil society activists and journalists. And although they always, of course, operated within some red lines and restrictions, nevertheless, that space was there. Since 2012, since Xi Jinping came in, and perhaps a little bit before he came to the top job, it started after the Beijing Olympics in 2008, but it really intensified under Xi Jinping. And essentially now, many, if not all, of those lawyers that I had met then disappeared, were either imprisoned, disbarred, or just simply disappeared. Most of civil society has been dismantled. There's really no such thing now as independent bloggers or journalists in the way that they did exist prior to 2012. And I think Xi Jinping has taken this incredibly intense, hardline approach of just eliminating all forms of dissent.
Yeah, and that's apparent in China, and also Hong Kong is a great example of that. I think, tying this all together, that one of the key themes in the book is this idea of the party and Xi Jinping, probably in particular, attempting to maintain power. One thing that was great in your book was that, you had so many interviews of different dissidents and activists, people who've, been in China or in the sort of neighboring countries and being directly impacted during this period of time. You quote Wei Jinsheng, and he's perhaps China's most prominent dissident. He, just for listeners, he spent most of his adult life in Chinese prisons for advocating for democracy in China. Now, in conversation with you in the book, you write that he said, "The so-called Chinese model has become very unstable. On the one hand, the party is very corrupt, and on the other hand, people are very dissatisfied. The regime realized that you cannot control society if you only control politics and not the economy. So they face a choice: reform the system and establish democracy, or go back to the Mao Zedong era. The party is afraid of losing power, and so Xi Jinping is reverting to Mao Zedong's playbook." I'm wondering if you can reflect somewhat on Wei Jingcheng's words.
Yes, I mean, I think those words were actually very prescient given what we saw happen in China late last year with the incredible protests, sparked, of course, by the zero COVID lockdown policies and a number of incidents, not least the fire in Urumqi. But what was very interesting was that in a lot of those protests, the protesters were not chanting lift the lockdown or end zero COVID. They were chanting CCP step down, Xi Jinping step down. And that combined with also the very courageous protest on the bridge just before the party congress, a few weeks before those other protests, I think those are signs of the discontent that Wei Jingcheng is referring to. And I think under Xi Jinping, the CCP has lost or is at least in danger of losing the kind of unspoken deal that they had with the people of China that kind of accorded them some degree of legitimacy, which was they allowed a certain amount of economic, well, they allowed China's economic miracle and a certain amount of growth that resulted in rising living standards, and they allowed this limited space in the 90s and 2000s for some degree of, you can't call it freedom, but some degree of relaxation of freedom of expression. And Xi Jinping now has cracked down on the political freedoms, but he's also failed to tackle corruption and seems to be going after entrepreneurialism and the kind of economic growth that Deng Xiaoping had envisaged. So he's sort of, you know, attacked both elements, and the economic growth is slowing down. And I think discontent is rising as a result.
Yeah, it was quite striking to see those protests. Turning to this sort of theme of crackdown, the next chapter is about Christians being under, being persecuted and targeted by the CCP. Going back a little bit again, in 1997, you met with one of the best known house church leaders in Beijing, and this was a really fascinating story. He was called Alan Yuan Xiangchen, and you quote him again. He said that Chinese Christians are like birds in a cage. Within the cage, there is freedom to fly around, but if Christians escape from the cage in search of real freedom, they are hunted down, captured, and put in a smaller cage. Often their wings are broken. Now, why would the CCP attack or persecute Christians? And can you sort of explain this a bit more?
Yes, I think the CCP, first of all, has always been very hostile to religion of any kind, because it's officially an atheist party, an atheist ideology. But secondly, it's also very nervous about any idea or movement that brings large numbers of people together, and any idea that it feels sort of challenges the communist ideology. And so I think those are the reasons it's always been repressive of Christianity. What's changed over time is that, you know, in the Mao era, they really tried to eliminate the church, and it was pretty much impossible, particularly during the Cultural Revolution, to be openly a Christian anywhere in China. Then under the Deng Xiaoping era and onwards, they realized they couldn't eliminate Christianity, so they tried to control it by establishing, these bodies already existed, but by sort of reviving the state-controlled church organizations. And their principle was, if you're a Christian and you want to worship in an unregistered house church that isn't under the control of the state, you're a target, and many people were arrested. And then there was a period where that appeared to ease a little bit, or at least it varied depending on where you were in China. And it was, the policy was in the hands of the local provincial authorities. And there were parts of China that were more relaxed and parts that were more hardline. But they did allow unregistered churches in certain places to exist and to grow to quite large numbers and even have their own buildings and be very public. And there was this sort of grey area that a blind eye was turned. But under Xi Jinping, he seems to have reverted to this real attempt to, if not eradicate it, certainly very tightly control it and impose sort of his personality cult on it.
Yeah, I remember reading in another book, another really good book about China in this period. It's called The Fight for China's Future by Wally Wolap Lam. I think you know him. He wrote that Christianity has the most members in China after the CCP of any sort of group. And because it is so large and it has the ability to unite people across provincial borders, so Christians are actually understood as a threat by the party to the party. And I think that's really interesting that you talk about, you know, this sort of threat that Xi Jinping perceives as a threat to, you know, his own ideology and his own personality cult. And this is why, you know, persecution of Christians has intensified under Xi Jinping. Turning to the next chapter, sort of moving slightly outside of China, but still, you know, with the same focus, it's on Tibet, and it's called Tibet, Bloodshed in the Land of Snows. And again, you quote, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Tsering Dawa. He's a former bank employee from the Lhasa who escaped Tibet in 2020. And some of these stories of people escaping out of Tibet in your book were just fascinating. It's not something I knew anything about. So he fled to India, and you quote, "The Chinese regime's key policy aim is to turn Tibetans into Chinese and Uyghurs into Chinese. So in order to really understand the Chinese Communist Party's repression everywhere, it is really important to understand its policies in Tibet and Xinjiang. There is a lack of attention towards Tibet at the moment, but as someone who was inside Tibet, what I learned was that any policy implemented in Tibet is subsequently implemented in Xinjiang and now Hong Kong. So if we do not know the situation in Tibet, we do not know the Chinese Communist Party. Can you tell me a little bit more about the situation in Tibet and the extent to which it can be understood as an indicator of the CCP's policy more broadly?"
Certainly. I mean, I have to say I found researching and writing the Tibet chapter of the book one of the most, probably the part of the book that I myself learnt so much that was new to me, because of all the issues, Tibet was the issue that I had least previous engagement on. I haven't had the chance to visit Tibet, unfortunately. But I carried out a lot of interviews with Tibetans, and I did a lot of background reading. I think it's really important, firstly, to remember that, of course, Tibet was invaded by the Chinese People's Liberation Army almost, you know, very soon after the creation of the People's Republic of China. And so it was the very first place of real repression and atrocities, and so Tibetans have been living under occupation for all these years. I think there was perhaps some periods of relative relaxation in the past, but what we've seen under Xi Jinping is a really intense crackdown. The party secretary who was the architect of the intense repression in Xinjiang, which many people would describe as a genocide, was interestingly previously the party secretary in Tibet. And Tibet was sort of his laboratory for increasing surveillance and increasing repression. And Tibetans that I interviewed basically said Tibet is like one large prison camp. And it's become much, much harder for Tibetans to get out. The escape routes that used to exist have tightened. And it really is, as they've told me, a prison state.
And, of course, in this sense, you know, China doesn't, there's not just this control by the CCP under Xi Jinping of Tibet internally, but, you know, there's this common theme of attempts to control and influence outside, you know, that sort of direct region. So, for example, you write about the Chinese regime has a habit of threatening foreign politicians who host or meet the Dalai Lama. Do you want to comment a little bit about this?
Yes. I mean, it's extraordinary. I don't think that you could ask for a more reasonable, moderate, good opponent, if you were the Chinese Communist Party, than His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I mean, he's bent over backwards to advocate dialogue, to advocate. He doesn't even advocate for Tibetan independence now. He advocates for some sort of autonomy. And yet the Chinese regime seems absolutely terrified of anyone meeting him, and they go out of their way to stop politicians meeting him and to threaten consequences if they do. And I interviewed a number of politicians who had met him but who had received lots of threats. The Speaker of the House of Commons at the time, John Bercow, told me that he hosted a lunch for the Dalai Lama and had lots of telephone calls from the Chinese embassy telling him to withdraw the invitation and threatening to complain to the British government about him. And he was able to laugh that off because he said they didn't seem to realize that the Speaker of the House of Commons is independent of the government. He was a particularly independent-minded speaker. But there's also the case of the fact that David Cameron, when he was leader of the opposition, criticized Gordon Brown for meeting the Dalai Lama, but not doing so in Downing Street. He met him in Lambeth Palace. But then when David Cameron was prime minister, he stopped some of his ministers visiting the Dalai Lama and didn't meet him in Downing Street. He did meet him outside. But so this pressure that China puts on politicians regarding the Dalai Lama is really intense.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, turning back to, you know, you just mentioned a moment ago, genocide against the Uyghurs. And the title of your next chapter is Uyghur Genocide, Call It By Name. So I want to understand why, you know, what does this title mean? And also, you know, you write about the Uyghur Genocide Tribunal and you were instrumental in setting this up. Can you tell me about, you know, genocide in Xinjiang region and also the tribunal?
Yes. So I feel it's very important to call it by name. Of course, it is a term that shouldn't be used lightly. It does have a very clear legal definition. The US State Department, both the previous administration and the current Biden administration, have both recognized it as a genocide. Several parliaments around the world have done so too. And then, of course, as you say, there was the Uyghur Tribunal, which came about because I happened to know Sir Geoffrey Nice, who ended up chairing it. And Sir Geoffrey is a very prominent British barrister. He'd been the prosecutor of Slobodan Milosevic. And I introduced him to some Uyghurs and asked whether there was something he could do to help us answer this question of, from a legal point of view, is it genocide or not? And so he put together this independent tribunal made up of people that didn't have any previous agenda with China. They weren't activists or campaigners. They were lawyers, academics, and experts. And they had a very rigorous process of public hearings and thousands of pages of written submissions. I attended the day when they presented the judgment. And I remember Sir Geoffrey going through meticulously the different counts of the different types of abuses taking place against the Uyghurs and whether they constituted genocide. And one by one, he would say, not proven, not proven, not proven. And I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, he's going to find that it's not genocide. What have I done? And then it came to the evidence of forced sterilization and forced abortions. And on that specific count, they found that it is genocide because under the Genocide Convention, you have to be able to prove intent to destroy in whole or in part a racial or religious group of people. And one of the arguments against calling it genocide is it the intention of the CCP to eliminate the Uyghur people? But I think you can see that with forced sterilization and forced abortions, that's very clear. I would say the other violations of extreme sexual violence, torture, slave labor, rounding millions of people up into prison camps, also indicate elements of genocide. But I think it's the forced sterilization that shows an intent to eliminate, at least in part, if not in whole, a people.
Yeah, that was fascinating, but also, you know, quite shocking to read about. The next chapter also was, it really took me aback. It was titled A Criminal State, The Persecution of Falun Gong and the Story of Forced Organ Harvesting. Now, I liked when I read, you know, you said you were a bit skeptical when you'd heard about this in the past. And to be honest, I'd felt exactly the same. It seemed just too awful to be true. So I'm wondering, what changed your mind and what have you learned about what the CCP is doing to members of Falun Gong?
I think one of the challenges about believing that this is happening is both that it sounds so horrific, but also, of course, that it's unlike other human rights violations. It's incredibly hard to find the evidence because, by definition, the victims don't survive when their organs are forcibly removed, and the witnesses are those who are parties to the crime. You know, the prison guards, the doctors who carry out the operation, and so on. So that's what makes it challenging. I think the thing that convinced me was, first of all, I came to know some of the expert researchers on this who are people of real distinction. The former Canadian politician David Kilgore, who sadly passed away last year, a Canadian lawyer David Matus, and an American journalist and researcher Ethan Gutman. And as I listened to them, I mean, they just had an air of credibility and plausibility that made me think, I don't think they're making this up. One of the things they presented was the evidence from China's own public records that of the number of organ transplants that are carried out in China. And there's a real disparity between, because China doesn't have a tradition of voluntary organ donation the way we do in the UK. And so there was a huge gap between the number of donors that there were and the large number of transplant operations that were carried out and the speed that you could get a transplant operation in China, you know, a matter of a few weeks, whereas in the UK it can take many months to find a matching donor. And so that raises the question, well, where are all these organs coming from? How are they able to find organs at such speed? And then I think those things convinced me that this is something serious, but I still felt there was a need for some further sort of verification from an independent body. And that's where, again, I turned to Sir Geoffrey Knight. I originally said to him, you know, I believe this is happening, but it's incredibly hard to prove. Would you consider examining the evidence that does exist and the research that's been carried out, and giving us a legal opinion? And he said, why don't we do something better than that? Why don't we hold an independent tribunal? And so he set that up a couple of years before the Uyghur tribunal, and they concluded that this is indeed happening and it's a crime against humanity.
And then in 1999, China's president at that time, Jiang Zemin, announced in a directive regarding the Falun Gong He wrote then, destroy their reputations, referring to the Falun Gong, cut them off financially and eradicate them physically. Can you reflect upon, you know, the extent to which that's come true?
I think it's certainly come true to quite a large extent. I know that many Falun Gong practitioners have over the years been rounded up, imprisoned, tortured very severely. And I've met Falun Gong practitioners who've left China who have firsthand accounts of this. I don't think they've managed to succeed in actually eliminating Falun Gong practice because, a bit like with Christianity, you know, they want to try and eliminate it because it's a belief that has the ability to mobilize large numbers and they feel threatened by that. But Falun Gong practitioners do continue, but they've suffered intense persecution.
And now I want to turn and look more in depth at Hong Kong and what's happened there in the last few years. That's the topic of the next chapter. And it's, you know, about the, you say, it's the all-out assault on Hong Kong's freedoms. And, you know, through your work and also especially, I assume, or I guess in through Hong Kong Watch, you've got to know a lot of, you know, really notable Hong Kongers, like politicians, activists, and many of them have either fled persecution or are now in prison. So one thing that really struck me is how the Hong Kong government's response to citizens' demands for things like universal suffrage, which we take for granted, have arguably had the opposite effect that the government's wanted. So rather than quelling the spirit of civil society, it's almost fortified the resilience of citizens. And this is especially evident in the last few years. And I think this is captured really well. One person you mentioned earlier was Alex Chow. He was one of the student leaders in 2014 Umbrella Movement, but he was also one of the very first people sent to prison for political activities. So you quote Alex, and he said of his time in prison, "When I left prison, I really started thinking about how we could reform and rebuild the city to make it more humane. Hong Kong could be a city that served everyone, regardless of age, sexuality, family background, income. That was my goal when I left prison, drawing on the insights I developed in prison. Being in prison was a transitional moment for me, from being an ordinary student who rose up in a leadership role in the movement to having some reflection in prison about Hong Kong's story. Can you tell me more about the transformation of Hong Kong in recent years and any warning signs you saw before that?"
Yes, I mean, the transformation has been pretty complete and total. When I first started to speak out on Hong Kong from about 2014 onwards, between 2014 and 2019, the warning signs were growing, but it was, I guess I'd say, a sort of steady pace of erosion rather than a dramatic crackdown. So we had the examples of, we talked about my own experience earlier, but more seriously, we had the examples of Alex, Nathan Law, and Joshua Wong being arrested and imprisoned, Nathan and other pro-democracy legislators being disqualified from the Legislative Council, having been elected in free elections, and we had the booksellers who were at various times abducted and disappeared into mainland China. So those were, and then of course we had, I remember on one occasion, some prominent Hong Kong pro-democracy politicians coming to London and talking in very technical terms about this danger of what they call co-location at the rail terminus, the high-speed rail terminus, where mainland Chinese law was going to be applied on Hong Kong soil just in the terminus, which by comparison with what's happened now seems a pretty obscure and sort of technical legal issue, even though it was spoken of very seriously at the time. But what we've seen since 2019 is a enormous change. We saw, of course, the shocking police brutality in response to the protests. Of course, there were some protesters who resorted to very extreme action as well. And I've never condoned that. But the vast majority of protesters were peaceful and yet were met with brutality by the police. And there's never been, in fact, it's now impossible really to expect any kind of accountability for the police, any kind of independent investigation. And then the national security law imposed in 2020 and the consequences of that basically has meant that civil society in Hong Kong has pretty much been entirely shut down. Certainly civil society that has any political nature. I'm sure some social charities can still continue, but trade unions and other political bodies, the impact on the curriculum in schools, academic freedom in universities, press freedom is probably one of the biggest issues where press freedom has been eliminated, essentially. All the independent and pro-democracy publications, Apple Daily being the most obvious, Stan News and others have been shut down. And Hong Kong really is a totally different place from the Hong Kong that certainly that I knew when I lived there, but even the Hong Kong of 3 or 4 years ago, where you could have space to express dissent. Now you could be charged under the national security law for doing so. And probably one of the most extraordinary aspects of the national security law is that they have this extraterritoriality clause that they use to threaten people well beyond Hong Kong's borders. And Hong Kong Watch is, you know, has experienced that. We received letters from the Hong Kong police and the National Security Bureau saying that what we're doing here in the UK is violating the national security law, and I could face a prison sentence if they could, if I were ever to go to Hong Kong. Which obviously it's a bit ironic because I'm banned from Hong Kong, but they tell me. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it would be funny, except it's not funny sort of thing. So then is Hong Kong Taiwan's canary in the coal mine?
Yes, I think it definitely is. Mm. And I think that, one of the reasons Taiwan's current president, Tsai Ing-wen, won re-election was because that was, I think, in 2019. And Taiwanese people looked and saw the police brutality in Hong Kong and could see that China was totally breaking its promises of one country, two systems. And mm-hmm. one country, two systems was the model that Deng Xiaoping, when he came up with it, originally had in mind for as a model for Taiwan. But I think Taiwanese people now, very vast majority of them would not want to have anything to do with that.
No, and so then why do you think the rest of the world should care about Taiwan, apart from the sort of reasons it's, good to care about others, but why does Taiwan matter?
I think there are several reasons why Taiwan really matters. I mean, first of all, it's in contrast to the People's Republic of China, Taiwan is a vibrant and very successful dynamic democracy and one of the few democracies in the region. So if we believe in democracy, it's in our interest to ensure that it's supported and not overturned by China. But also, Taiwan, of course, is the most significant, largest producer of semiconductors, the microchips that power almost all our electronic gadgets, our mobile phones, our laptops, everything. And if that were to fall into the hands of CCP, I think that would be a grave danger to the rest of the world. In addition to that, Taiwan is an important economy, an important trading partner, and the economic crisis that would inevitably follow for the whole world, were an invasion to take place, would be enormous. And then lastly, I think Taiwan is in a very strategic position in the the chain of islands in that part of the world. And I think Japan, Korea, Philippines, and others in the island chain would feel pretty threatened if China invaded and if it was successful in its invasion of Taiwan. So for all those reasons, Taiwan definitely matters.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a huge amount of really important reasons, like democracy, economics, technology, especially, you know, the sort of technological implications. You know, you look at China and, you know, WeChat, the sort of main social media communications, it's completely monitored and censored. So, yeah, if the CCP was to control that globally, that would, you know, have huge ramifications for every person on a day-to-day level. Now, Ben, your work isn't limited just to sort of China and, you know, Hong Kong, Taiwan, these sort of areas. But also in China's backyard, you've made several trips to Myanmar, and you've written a lot about Beijing's complicity with Myanmar's crimes against humanity. And, you know, this was really interesting because you personally ended up in some really hairy situations on these visits. So I'd like to hear more about these incidents, not just because they were interesting, but how did you become involved in advocacy for Myanmar from a China perspective?
Well, I first got involved in Myanmar actually when I was living in Hong Kong, so, mm-hmm. you know, 20 years or more ago. And it came about because I had a friend who was doing a lot of work on the with refugees on the Thailand-Myanmar border. And I had traveled with that particular friend to East Timor, where I'd previously been quite involved. And he told me more about the situation in Myanmar. And so I traveled with him to the Thailand border, and that's how it began. And then I made many visits, both to the Thailand-Myanmar border, several visits to the China-Myanmar border, to the Kachin ethnic people, some visits to the India border, and many visits inside Myanmar. I try not to make a habit of getting kicked out of countries, but in addition to being denied entry to Hong Kong, I was twice deported from Myanmar, and so had that experience. That predated my incident in Hong Kong, But I'd also crossed, as I say, several times from China into Myanmar, actually without a visa. I mean, I went with the Kachin resistance army, and on one occasion, the territory that they control at that time, they had a ceasefire with the Myanmar military, which they don't now, but they had an agreement with the Myanmar military that although they controlled that territory, the military could pass through from time to time, you know, with permission. And so on one particular occasion, I was in a hotel in Kachin State, across the border from China, in Kachin-held territory. And I got a message asking me not to go out of my room and not to the hotel, but to stay where I was until I was given the all clear, because one of Myanmar's most senior generals was passing through and was having lunch two or three floors below me. And I think if he'd known who was in the hotel a few floors above him, he wouldn't have been at all happy. In terms of China's relationship with Myanmar, I mean, I gradually became more and more aware of this. And I think What's especially disturbing is that since the coup in Myanmar on the 1st of February 2 years ago, it's clear that on the one hand, China is not necessarily happy with the Myanmar military, because what China really wants is stability in Myanmar in order to pursue its economic interests in the country. But on the other hand, they're obviously no friend of democracy. And although they were prepared to have a relationship with Aung San Suu Kyi and the democratic government for convenience, when the coup happened, you know, they did nothing to criticize it or to stop it. And indeed, they've been the Myanmar military's biggest backer, together with Russia, in terms of providing arms, providing political and diplomatic cover, and sustaining an economic lifeline, without which the Myanmar military probably would not survive.
So I want to go back to this theme that comes through in the book, this idea, you know, you do have this habit of either being kicked out of countries or being chased by, you know, Chinese police officers. And this happened again when you were in northern China, and you're visiting some northern Korea escapees. So you made then a narrow escape from the Chinese police. But you acknowledge that if you were caught, you might have spent a short time in a Chinese prison and then be deported, but the lives of the North Koreans would have been seriously endangered. So can you tell me a little bit about the work you were doing then, and the stories of the North Korean escapees, which were just harrowing?
Yes. So I've worked on North Korea for a number of years. And I have a very good friend who has been particularly assisting North Korean North Korean escapees for many years. He offered me the opportunity to go with him to northern China to see the situation firsthand and hear the stories firsthand. And as you say, the stories are really harrowing. It's a sign of how desperate the situation in North Korea is that North Koreans have been willing to take the risks involved in escaping, in the knowledge that firstly, if they're caught by the Chinese, China has a policy of sending them back to North Korea to a potential execution, certainly a definite prison term and severe torture. Women have suffered hugely in terms of being trafficked, either as and sold as either as wives to Chinese men, or into the sex trade or other forms of modern day slavery. And it's appalling the way they're treated. But the fact that North Koreans are willing to risk these dangers just shows how even worse the situation in North Korea is. I was very privileged to see and to hear these stories and to see people, to see the situation. Unfortunately, Xi Jinping, as part of his overall crackdown on everything, has made that work even more difficult. And the combination of Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un together, because Kim Jong-un has tightened the border. I mean, he tightened it particularly during COVID because of fear about the pandemic. But I think it's very convenient for the North Korean regime that now it's much, much more difficult for people to escape. And Xi Jinping, of course, doesn't want people escaping either. So these two dictators have made life even worse for North Koreans and for anyone trying to assist them.
And yet China seems to be instrumental in propping up North Korea. Can you just briefly reflect on that?
Yes. So again, there's some parallels with China's relations with North Korea and its relations with Myanmar, in the sense that actually they're not necessarily that keen on the two regimes. They would probably rather a regime that was authoritarian but a bit more stable and less of a threat to peace in the region. But what they certainly don't want is democracy. They definitely don't want a united Korea that is democratic and aligned to the Western world. And so they are propping up the regime economically, again, with diplomatic and political cover in the United Nations and elsewhere, and not... I mean, there was a time where there were some signs they might be more helpful on the nuclear proliferation issue. But even that, they haven't really exerted their influence properly with North Korea. So they are keeping the North Korean regime afloat in the same way that they're doing with the Myanmar regime.
And then finally, sort of bringing all of these points together, the last chapter is called Wake Up Call, What the Free World Must Do to Fight for Freedom. And now, as the book is titled, it truly is a nexus of the CCP's tyranny throughout this region. And this is a strength that does set your book apart, I think, from other books on China. So bringing this nexus together, I'm wondering, what should the free world do to fight for freedom?
So I think the first step is to wake up to the seriousness of the challenge. And I think that is starting to happen. And I detail in that chapter how in just the last two or three years, there has definitely been a shift in both the US, in the UK, in Europe and other countries. It's probably not as advanced as I would like it to be, but it's beginning to happen. I think the second thing that the free world should do is as much as possible to unite to confront this threat. I sometimes say that we need a united front to counter China's united front, because I think the more coordinated we can do, we may not necessarily all do the same thing exactly, but if we can coordinate together, it makes it harder for Beijing to retaliate or to divide and rule. And so that's really important. And I think I set out in the book a range of other things that we should be doing, both to speak up and hold China accountable for its human rights violations at home. And that includes targeted sanctions, not sanctions against the people of China, but targeted sanctions against officials in Beijing and in Hong Kong and in Xinjiang for their abuses. And particularly for breaking an international treaty, the China-British Joint Declaration in Hong Kong. But I also think that we should be reducing our dependency on China, diversifying our supply chains, and lastly, looking at how we can help people in China and Hong Kong, both in their struggle for freedom at home, but also if they need to, how we can help them to get out and find sanctuary. And obviously, the UK has done that in a very big way with Hong Kongers, with the British National Overseas Scheme. I'd like to see other countries provide lifeboat schemes to help Hong Kongers, but also to help Uyghurs and others.
Yeah, and that's a really important message, I think, you know, the importance of speaking up, not just for our own interests, but, you know, speaking up because for those who are unable to because of the repression and the tyranny that's going on and offering those lifeboats. So, Ben, I've taken up quite a lot of your time, but just before you go, what are you working on now? What's next?
Well, there's still obviously the work of getting the book out there, and so having opportunities to talk about it like this is really welcome. There'll be a very good visit to Canada and the US, where I did something like 16 events in 14 days for the book. There'll be a few events in the UK coming up. But besides that, you know, my work with Hong Kong Watch continues, and we have an exciting program of engagement with the community outreach with the Hong Kong community, both in the UK and in Canada, helping them to understand their civil and political rights here and how they can engage with the political system here in their new their new home. We'll be really pressing for more work on sanctions, because the Hong Kong government, Hong Kong officials and Beijing officials have not yet been sanctioned by the UK. So that's something we'll be pressing. We'll keep the spotlight on political prisoners and trials in Hong Kong, particularly Jimmy Lai's trial later this year. And we have a number of research projects and new publications coming out. So, yeah, a whole range of things, but no plans for another book just yet. I think it'll be a while before I do another one.
Well, it sounds like you're going to be kept very busy nonetheless, doing very important work, even if you're not writing a book.
Yes, absolutely. It's always busy.
Benedict Rogers, it's been really great speaking to you today. We've been speaking about your latest book, The China Nexus, 30 Years in and Around the Chinese Communist Party's Tyranny. I'm Jane Richards, and this is a podcast on New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network.